Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. As the COVID-19 pandemic sweeps through our communities, residents in our region are finding themselves in uncharted territory, often with more questions than answers. Today, there are more than 700 confirmed cases in Wisconsin, according to Johns Hopkins University, with at least 12 deaths, including one announced overnight in Iron County. The numbers are climbing each day. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. These are unprecedented times, as businesses have been forced to close, residents are asked to stay at home, and the number of infections continues to rise. This week is the first in a two-part series dedicated to the COVID-19 outbreak and its effect on North Central Wisconsin. While next week's show will focus on the human impact, this week we're focusing on science, separating fact from fiction. Joining us today, a trio of experts to answer common questions, dispel misinformation, and offer solid advice to keep you and your families healthy. From the Marathon County Health Department, we welcome Public Information Officer Judy Burrows. Judy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sarah Sewell is a pathologist in Wausau. She's also joining us today. Dr. Sewell, welcome to Route 51.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Our third guest is the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospitals and Clinics. It's Dr. Nasia Safdar. Thanks so much for being here today as well.
Thank you.
What questions do you have about COVID-19? You can email those questions to us directly at route51@wpr.org. You can join the conversation by phone by calling 800-780-9742. I'd like to start today by asking Dr. Safdar to explain exactly what COVID-19 is and how is it different from seasonal flu or past viruses like H1N1, for example?
So COVID-19 is caused by a virus called SARS-CoV-2, and it's one of a family of coronaviruses that have a very broad array of members in that family. The common coronaviruses that we see every season when respiratory illness season hits are those that cause cold-like symptoms. Most of the time, testing isn't even needed to determine whether a coronavirus is the cause. Individuals recover and things are fine. This is, even though this is in the family of coronaviruses, the SARS-CoV-2 virus is behaving very differently from other coronaviruses. And in that family of coronaviruses, there are others that also behave differently, like MERS and SARS that were reported several years ago. I think the difference between SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19, the illness, is that the human population has not been exposed to the best of our knowledge to this before. And so no one in the population has any pre-existing immunity to it. Therefore, we don't quite know what to expect in terms of its impact when people get sick, how quickly they will recover, what sort of complications one might expect.
So how is it transmitted? What do we know about that? Is it airborne, is it from touching people? What do we know?
The transmission is via large droplets. So if an individual who has COVID-19 or is coughing or sneezing, there's this plume that is released when you cough or sneeze, but these are large droplets. So they go into the air and then they fall down to the ground. And that distance is typically, this is why the 6 feet physical distancing is so important, because that's the distance that something will typically travel when somebody's coughing or sneezing. So droplet is a major route. A secondary route would be if somebody were to touch surfaces that are contaminated and then touch their nose or their mouth, which is how this would spread to the respiratory system then.
Okay, so that helps us understand what that 6 foot social distancing thing is all about. Judy, we hear a lot about flattening the curve, and maybe you can explain, what does that mean exactly? What is this curve based on?
Well, the curve is really, it's a visual, which might be a little bit challenging for the listeners to imagine. But if you can imagine two curves happening. One curve is a slow kind of gradient like a hill, and the other curve being a huge spike like a mountain. And what we're trying to do when we talk about slowing the curve is we're trying to encourage people to use social distancing and good infection control practices in order to slow the spread of the disease, so that the number of people that we see being infected each day and the numbers of cases that we're finding each day begin to resemble that slow curve that looks like a hill. In other words, it goes up and it gradually then comes back down versus a spike that goes up and looks more like a mountain. The reason that we're trying to prevent that spike is because we know that our healthcare system has a capacity for the number of people that they can serve. And if our trend for the number of cases that we have looks like that spike, our hospitals will exceed their capacity. Our clinic systems will exceed their capacity. And then we run into a scenario like many people have seen on the news, like in Spain and Italy, where we have patients in hallways and in some very, very sad situations. So we want to slow the curve. And that's what we mean by flattening the curve. We want it to feel like a hill and not a mountain.
Dr. Sewell, maybe you can answer this. We've heard a lot about who's at risk. People with underlying health conditions, for example, or the elderly. Do people in other age groups or without those risk factors really have reason to be concerned?
Yeah. Fortunately, the group that seems to be most protected, and I think we've all have heard this, are kids. So in general, kids either have a mild infection or might be asymptomatic. Once you get into the adult population, going from 18 up, those individuals from like 18 to 40, originally the data coming out of China was that, low likelihood of anything severe, but some of the first things that we're seeing here, especially coming out of New York, is that there are cases where some of those younger people are ending up in critical condition and needing significant support, being on ventilators. So my feeling about that is the thing that ends up putting people in that extreme condition is something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. And that's something that can be, we see that outside of the COVID situation. People will come to the hospital, they'll have some sort of a viral illness, and we don't know which people are going to go into that ARDS situation. But what ends up happening is, for some reason, there's a trigger that the immune response within the body makes it so that people are no longer able to do adequate air exchange, really, in their lungs. So your lungs normally have a very thin lining where oxygen is going from the outside air into your blood cells and carrying oxygen to your body. When you're in this critical situation, what's happening is the lining cells are sloughing off of the lungs, and also inflammatory cells are kind of rushing to that area and also filling that airspace. So when you have the sloughed off lining cells and the inflammatory cells all in that area, you lose that thin membrane where the oxygen is supposed to transfer over, and instead it's thick. And so that's where people get in trouble. So there's nothing to say that, only the people with underlying conditions, they're at increased risk, that's for sure. But the younger population can still slip into this ARDS situation.
Okay. We have Chris from Adams on the phone. Chris has a question for you. Thanks for joining, Chris.
Hi. It's actually a comment. I have two autoimmune diseases, and for years and years and years and years, I have been dealing with trying to get this whole situation with my body, like, in tune. And what I have been noticing, because I eat really, really well, and I keep my immune system up and running as much as I possibly can. A lot of people are going into the grocery store and buying the most garbage food that they can possibly get their hands on, and just hunkering down and saying, I don't care, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And what you need to do is go online and look up how you can make yourself more powerful in your own body by eating right.
All right. What do you have to say about the role of nutrition? Perhaps Dr. Sapter, you could address that question.
Sure. I think, just as you mentioned, there is tremendous value in good nutrition, and this is not the time to change that aspect of it. The specific benefits to COVID-19 might not be immediately apparent, but given that we know nutrition plays a powerful role in maintaining our health, it's good to focus on that right now.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about testing, because I will say that in the Central Wisconsin Facebook group, we're seeing more questions about testing pretty much than anything else. And the governor's legal counsel during a press call this week told reporters that the actual numbers in Wisconsin could be in the thousands. Of course, we have the confirmed cases in about 700 or so. So who's being tested and who is not? Judy, maybe this is a question for you.
Sure. Testing, first of all, testing is happening through healthcare providers, not at public health agencies. And so individuals who are seeking testing need to work through the health system that they're already working with and find out how that system is administering tests, because they are, you know, of course, discouraging people showing up and just asking. They want to screen people before they come in. So testing occurs in the clinical setting, and then those test results are sent to labs for processing. It does take about 2 days to run that test, and then you can add on a little more time for transportation and, quite frankly, a little bit of backlogging that's happened because we don't have all of the labs in Wisconsin online and ready to do testing. So patients who are having symptoms or people who are having symptoms can seek testing from their providers.
Okay. I did speak with a healthcare provider in Wausau this week who said the bottom line with testing is we would be able to quell the spread if everyone could be tested so that asymptomatic people don't spread the virus. Is there something to that, Dr. Sapdar?
I think, you know, it appears that there's a contribution of asymptomatic individuals to transmission. But I think the important thing would be that we test those that have symptoms, and once we feel that we have done a great job with that, then the asymptomatic population could be considered potentially. At the moment, we still don't really have a great handle on the burden of disease in a particular region because the testing has not been able to be done to the level that we would normally do when we were trying to learn everything about a condition. Who are the people that get affected? Where does it appear to be mild in? So all of that data is coming in, but a lot of our initial knowledge was based on knowledge from what was happening in other countries, some of which is applicable here, but not all of that is.
Judy Burrows, Dr. Sarah Sewell, and Dr. Nessia Sapdar are our guests today in the first of two programs on the COVID-19 outbreak and the impact in our region. When we return, we'll have more about the science behind the Safer at Home order, symptoms to watch for, and ways to keep yourself safe during this time. Join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email questions to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Nessia Sapdar from UW Hospitals and Clinics, Wausau pathologist Dr. Sarah Sewell, and Marathon County Health Department Public Information Officer Judy Burrows are here today as we continue our discussion on the science surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. We'd like to hear from you too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. There's been a lot of discussion nationwide about the impact on hospitals. In Atlanta, I was seeing this on the news yesterday, in Atlanta, health officials announced that their facilities were nearing or at capacity, and they're actually looking at setting up field hospitals. Do you think Wisconsin has enough hospital beds to handle the surge that could be coming? Dr. Sapdar? Let's ask, maybe yes. You can answer that question. Do you think Wisconsin is going to have enough hospital beds to handle the surge? What does the situation look like?
I think it will largely depend on the size of the surge. I think if the initial estimates on the social distancing interventions seem to pan out, then we might be in a better position than we think we are currently. But yes, it is correct that it is possible that health systems may be overwhelmed by the surge.
Do we know how many hospital beds we have in Wisconsin? Judy, do you know?
Unfortunately, I do not have that number for you. I apologize.
I'm sorry for putting you on the spot. I was just wondering, case-wise, what we're looking at. Let's shift a little bit, though, to symptoms. We had a question from a listener who wanted to know how long it takes between the time of exposure to the time symptoms appear. Dr. Sewell, maybe you can answer that question.
It's variable, but the idea is often it can be up to 7 days before that first symptom is seen, and even sometimes can be up to 2 weeks. That's where that 2-week quarantine comes in.
Okay, and does the time between exposure and infection differ based on risk factors like underlying health conditions, or doesn't that matter?
I don't think that there's data to show that yet. That's still a question mark.
Okay. One of our listeners, Mindy, emailed us with the question, can you take ibuprofen with the virus? We've seen a lot of this on the internet, actually, a lot of people sharing this advice that you can't take ibuprofen with the virus. Dr. Safdar, is that true?
I think as a blanket statement, that is not true. Initially, there were some reports about potentially ibuprofen not being a great idea to take in patients with COVID-19, but since then there hasn't been any new or more rigorous data, and the FDA released a statement recommending that patients follow their physician's advice, and if ibuprofen is the best thing for their care, then they should take that. I think we don't want to compromise the best medical care we have available in the pursuit of things where we don't know if how important that finding really is when it's very preliminary. So I would say worth discussing for sure with your healthcare provider, that they may feel that for you in your current state, ibuprofen is still the best choice.
Since we're talking about medications, I'd also like to ask, what kinds of treatments are showing promise? We've heard about drugs for malaria. Is that something that you think has the potential to be a game changer here, Dr. Safdar?
I don't think I would go quite that far. I think that because this is a new and emerging condition and it's causing serious illness in some people that have it, everyone is understandably very eager to find anything that could work. But sometimes the first reports of potentially promising things aren't borne out by later well-controlled trials, which many of these things are being tested in. So I think it has potential, but I can't say that we are confident that it will change the face of treatment of COVID-19.
Dr. Sewell, do you know whether we have clear indication of whether or not people who get coronavirus can be reinfected? Are they immune afterward? What do we know so far?
The idea now is that if you get it, you most likely cannot get it again. Again, we don't have all the data to say 100% that that's definitely the answer, but everything's pointing towards the idea that once infected, the chance of being reinfected is unlikely.
Judy, what are you hearing from officials on whether or not there's an indication that we may see a second wave of this in the future? Is it too soon to tell? What are experts telling you?
Everything that I've seen thus far has indicated that we don't know if there will be a second wave of this, but I think all we can do is really look back at places that have experienced things that already that we are currently experiencing and seeing what we can learn from it. There is some research happening to look at, what that immunity looks like, and I think time will tell.
So one question, too, that I've got is on the impact on rural hospitals. We were talking about this amongst ourselves this week. I know that smaller hospitals have traditionally been able to transfer the most critically ill patients to larger hospitals, and then they're also kind of surviving on these really razor-thin margins that depend largely on those elective surgeries and things that have been called off. Judy, what do you think the impact is going to be on rural hospitals as we move forward?
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because we've had some questions coming into our agency recently, and some of our northern counties have put some information out that relates to this. We've got a population of folks in northern Wisconsin that have homes there as well as homes in the south. And this is about the time of the year when we see some of those folks traveling between those places. one of the concerns that some of our counties have is people traveling back from other places, potentially coming back infected, and then, you know, taking up residence in their summer home in central or northern Wisconsin. And those healthcare facilities in those smaller rural areas don't have the capacity that's needed should we see a lot of cases happening there. We know what happens in the summer in northern Wisconsin. It's a lot of tourism and a lot of folks living there and enjoying the great outdoors. But our healthcare system in the northern region does not have the capacity to serve a lot of people. And that's concerning. And so we are asking people to stay in place and wait for this to settle down. Let us flatten the curve. And then hopefully things will be back to normal and people can come back to their residences here.
No, that's interesting. We've gotten news releases from a number of northern Wisconsin counties, Oneida, one of them, saying, hey, if you've got a vacation home here, don't come right now. You know, stay where you are. So it's interesting to see the counties taking such an active role in keeping people at home. Dr. Sewell, I wanted you to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about social distancing. I know you feel very strongly about social distancing and why it's so important. You want to address that?
Sure. I mean, so social distancing right now is really the only tool we have in our toolbox to try and, as we keep talking about, flatten the curve and to stop the spread. So the thing to remember right now is that the numbers that we're seeing of positive people in the state, I think we're all pretty aware, aren't accurate because we don't have the amount of testing that we would need to get that real number out there. So two things to consider. In general, people are getting symptoms 1 to 7 days after they are infected with COVID. And then if they, at 7 days, they go for testing. Sometimes it's taking up to 7 days to get the testing results back. So you're looking at a two-week window here where the numbers that we're seeing being reported aren't accurate. So you have this kind of a two-week lag behind of the numbers and what's really happening in the community. So what I'm hoping is that people are realizing the severity of what's going on across the world and now we're seeing in our own country, and realizing that even if our numbers, let's say, for example, in Marathon County, we have a number of one positive, that's not accurate for what's really out in the community. So the need for social distancing is so important to really focus on that, at least give us 2, 4, 6 weeks here so that things can basically slow down, because what we need is time for the testing to catch up, for our volume, our ability to test as many people as we want, and also for the production of additional PPE or the personal protective equipment for people at the front lines, people that are administering the testing. So we really need that slow down period. That's where social distancing is so important right now.
I want to invite listeners to call in with their questions. The number to call, 800-780-9742. You can also email questions to us at route51@wpr.org. One of the things that that people ask all the time is how many people are being tested? How many tests are pending? Judy, do we have any sense, at least in Marathon County, of how many tests are out there waiting for answers? How many tests are pending? Is that hard to calculate?
It's a little bit hard for us to calculate because on our end in the public health department, we see the number of tests that have been done. The number of tests that are being done are coming from multiple healthcare systems. And so it's a little bit difficult for us to know when a provider, you know, in that moment, when the provider actually performs the test and sends it into the laboratory. We see it at the end of that testing process when the lab result is completed. So So, you know, the lag time on that is makes our numbers look a little bit low, but I can assure you that our health care providers are testing.
Okay. Dr. Safdar, what's your sense of how many people do you think actually will need hospitalization? We know that the majority of people who do get coronavirus do recover. How many people will get really sick and how many people will really need hospitalization? Do you know?
So the best estimates seem to be that 80% of the population will have mild disease, 20% will end up requiring hospitalization, and 5% will require ICU care.
Okay. And Dr. Sewell, what is the current situation with protective gear? You mentioned that before. Is there enough to go around? What's the situation locally?
What I'm hearing locally is that what the aim is to really try and conserve it. So there is equipment available right now. However, we're not using it in the same way we would have been using it this fall. You know, we're repeating usage of some of these specialized N95 respirator masks, some gloves. You know, sometimes when people glove up, they're reusing those. They're sanitizing the gloves between patients. But different hospitals, different private groups, different clinics have different methods on how they're trying to conserve. So right now, they have equipment. They're trying to conserve it, and the question is, do we have enough to withstand the surge that's coming, or how, you know, if there's a surge, how big it's going to be? So the idea is let's conserve as much as we can right now.
One question from a listener, Lynn, wanted to know if pets can become infected. Dr. Safdar, what do we know?
So there isn't any data to support that pets can become infected. I think in the absence of that data, I think people and agencies are recommending that for patients that are in self-isolation for COVID-19, that they also isolate themselves from their pets.
Okay. What about a vaccination? We've seen a lot of things. Companies across the globe are racing to find a vaccination for this. Is a vaccination on the horizon? And if so, how long will that take typically to get out to the public? Dr. Safdar.
So I think vaccine development is in the works, and by the usual timeline that vaccines get developed, it is on an accelerated timeline. But having said that, it still takes several months before something can be tested adequately to make sure that it works and then gets deployed for use. So there's a number of steps that have to be followed, and they can be accelerated, but they still have to be followed. So I don't think we can say that there's imminent appearance of a vaccine on the horizon yet. But I think that an intense amount of research and activity is going on in that area.
Okay. Dr. Sewell, in your opinion, are we overreacting to this by forcing people to stay at home? There's a lot of discussion in chat groups and on stories, and we're hearing a lot of people who are arguing about this. Is this all a big overreaction, or is this a necessary thing for the safety of our community?
Definitely a necessary thing for our community. I mean, basically all you have to do is turn on. I think it's easy to maybe question that when it's in a different country and it's not in the U.S., but as you're watching these things happen in our own country, New York, New Orleans, they're saying Florida might be next, Atlanta, it's here. We don't have accurate data to be able to tell people how widespread it is, but we know that it's more widespread than what our data is showing. And so it is extremely important for our community, our state, to try and flatten our own curve. Maybe we can look different than New York. We can look different than Florida. Within our own state, it's so important in this very unique short window to try and flatten that curve. I wish that everybody would really take that message to heart, because there can be so many potential asymptomatic carriers out there that could be spreading it, and it's just critical right now. And everybody keeps talking about exponential growth, so that this spread can be doubling in 2 or 3 days. The number of infected can increase in that short of time. So, again, right now the time period is so critical.
Judy, what do you say about that? I mean, to people that say this is an overreaction, what is your response?
I absolutely agree with everything Dr. Sewell said, and I this is real and it's here. And my hope is that 2 months from now, somebody will say to me, oh, we overreacted because no one else got sick. If they can say that to me, then I will have proof that the social distancing worked. So that is my wish for the future, is that people do this because it does make a difference. I can't stress enough how important the social distancing is.
One question that we've had from readers and listeners, they want to know if they can get COVID-19 from touching food or packaging during restaurant delivery or pickup. Is there any risk there if you're getting food to go that's been prepared for you and you're taking it home to your family? Should we be worried about that at all? Perhaps Dr. Scepter, you could answer that.
So I think that, you know, in terms of the main route of transmission, it's droplet and it's contact with contaminated surfaces with COVID-19 that then you take to your nose and mouth. Our opportunity to interrupt that transmission is by way of hand hygiene. So even if you touch something where you might be concerned that there's contamination, if you do hand hygiene right after that, then there should be no risk to you. In terms of virus viability, there's been one study that I'm aware of that looks at how long it can be detected on surfaces, which doesn't directly equate to transmissibility. Just because it's there doesn't mean that it can be transmissible. But this would be a relatively easy way for people to be comfortable that if you just do hand hygiene reliably, regularly, and carefully, that that would interrupt that possibility.
And similarly, we were hearing this week that the virus can stay on cardboard for a length of time. Is picking up packages that come to you in the mail, is that all safe? Is that all okay?
With hand hygiene, yes.
Okay, so wash your hands afterward. Mm-hmm. All right. You're listening to Dr. Sarah Sewell, Dr. Nasya Safter, and Judy Burrows in the first of two programs on the impact of COVID-19 in our region. When we return, we'll talk more about what hospitals and health departments are doing to prepare and what you can do to help flatten the curve in our region. What questions do you have for our guests? You can call us at 800-780-9742. Email your questions to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Siewert, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Route 51. I'm Shereen Siewert. Dr. Nasya Safdar from UW Hospitals and Clinics, Wausau pathologist Dr. Sarah Sewell, and Marathon County Health Department Public Information Officer Judy Burrows are here today as we continue our discussion on the science surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. This is the first of two programs dedicated to the issue. Your questions are welcome, too. Email us at route51@wpr.org. You can give us a call, too, 800-780-9742. Just got an email from Becky, and Becky is asking, being in the at-risk population and going to make an appointment to receive a vaccination for shingles and pneumonia, would that pneumonia vaccine be beneficial because COVID-19 creates pneumonia-like issues? Dr. Safdar, what do you think about that? Does the pneumonia vaccine help in this instance?
So I think one of the challenges with COVID-19 is that the symptoms can look very much like any other respiratory virus, or in the case of pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia as well in some cases. And so anything that would help us distinguish which is more likely if somebody has been vaccinated against some of these other things, that makes it less likely they will get those. So there's no direct benefit on COVID-19 per se, but it's helpful to get vaccinated for other things like influenza and pneumonia so that those can be, you know, considered less likely.
All right. We've heard a lot about shortages in supply chains. This has been a big topic of conversation nationally. Everything from smaller items like gloves and masks and gowns to major equipment like ventilators. And I know we touched on that briefly earlier in the program, but I'd like to address the mask issue. A lot of people are sewing masks. They're donating them to local hospitals. I also heard from a Wausau doctor who shared some CDC recommendations that kind of discouraged the use of cloth and paper masks in some scenarios, but people want to help. So is this a good way to do it? Should they be doing this? Is this helpful? Dr. Sewell, what do you think?
Well, some of the CDC recommendations, they recommend that once for healthcare providers, if they have nothing else available, their last recommendation for masking is to use a bandana. Like, that's what they have in their recommendation guidelines. So obviously these home sewn masks would be one step up from that. Where I see the benefit of the home sewn masks are more for patients that are coming in to be seen. They are showing up with cough, and to protect the people taking care of them from those large droplets. So, you know, when you normally would go into the doctor and it would say, if you have a cough, please wear a mask, that kind of a usage just to protect from those large droplet spreads, I can see value in using it in that instance.
All right. I just got a message from Paul in Wausau who's asking this. In the 7 day to symptoms and then up to 14 days to confirm, when are you able to transmit to others? When are you actively giving that virus to somebody else, perhaps not knowingly? And how soon do you spread it after you've been exposed? Dr. Sefter, do you know the answer to that?
So I think from the standpoint of being able to transmit before you're symptomatic, I would say a couple of days before that. It's not a very scientific estimation at that point, because we don't fully know for asymptomatic people the transmission potential, but there is belief that there is at least some. So a few days before symptoms start, you can transmit it. The individual that is exposed has then a 14-day period to develop symptoms. After 14 days, if they haven't developed symptoms, then we can say that they did not get the illness. Once somebody has COVID-19, they may be sick for a highly variable period of time, and it's recommended that they self-isolate until their symptoms have completely recovered and a certain number of days after, which depends upon a specific population and whether there's a test available to confirm that the virus is no longer present in the nose. So a complicated answer, but I think the gist of it is that you self-isolate for as long as you have to until your symptoms are fully better and when public health has cleared you.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about protective measures at home. Judy, what are some of the best things that people can do to protect themselves if they have to go out in public? Some people who are obviously are still working out in the public. What can we do at home to keep ourselves safe?
Well, the first thing that we all need to be doing is washing our hands frequently and doing it the right way. So that's, you know, 20 seconds with warm water and soap and some scrubbing between fingers, under fingernails, et cetera, and doing that frequently. So once you've decided to take that trip out of the house to go get your groceries or other essentials that you absolutely need, when you come home, again, the first thing you need to do is wash your hands again. When you're out and about, please practice social distancing. I've noticed at the grocery store that they now have tape on the floor to help you see what 6 feet is, and so that you can keep yourself 6 feet away from the person in front of you. So all of the measures that you would use out in the community related to social distancing, you can also practice in your home, particularly if you have someone in your home that might be experiencing symptoms, whether they're COVID-related symptoms or not. Again, keeping social distancing happening even within the home is going to be useful.
Okay. What about antibacterial soaps? Do those make sense? Do they make a difference?
Judy? Soap and water are most effective. When soap and water is not available, hand sanitizers are useful, but the hand sanitizer needs to be 60% alcohol in order to be as effective as we need it to be.
Okay. I know that there is a lot of emphasis on hand washing, and so that is really good information. We've seen photos on social media of social distancing parties. I don't know if you've seen these, but there are groups of people that get together. They're sitting 6 feet apart, but they're still coming over to each other's houses. Is this a good idea? Is this safe? Dr. Sewell, what do you think about that?
I would say it's probably not the best choice right now. I know that people are craving to have social interaction. They, you know, are upset that their lives are kind of being put on a standstill right now. But my fear is that, you know, it starts out as an idea of, yep, we're socially distanced, we're 6 feet apart. Are they really, you know, maintaining that 6 feet distance? Are people going in to get a drink or use the restroom and they're now touching the same doorknobs? Are they being sanitized in between? Are they switching chairs that they're using? All of these things, just you're opening yourself up. It's basically like a can of worms. I think at this point, for public safety, those things shouldn't be happening. In a few weeks, it may very well look different. But what we're asking right now is, this is a crucial time, you know, out of care for your neighbors, your family members. Those are not good choices right now.
So we know that federal privacy laws prevent the release of names when there's a known case. Judy, this question's for you. Is the health department notified whenever there is a suspected case? And what happens then?
We're notified when a person has been tested for COVID. And then our function is to do monitoring and surveillance. And so one of our professionals will be contacting the person who's been tested to find out a little bit more about who that person may have been in contact with, what that person's daily life has been like, when they first experienced symptoms. And we use that as a means to help identify who else that person may have come into contact with and who we might need to connect with and talk to and share with them that they may have been in contact with somebody who is suspected of having COVID.
Then in the case when there's a positive, how are affected people notified, Judy?
Well, they generally are told by their healthcare provider, and about the same time we receive those results as well, and so then we outreach to them. So that it could be that they're hearing from us first, but it's more likely that they're hearing it from their provider before they're hearing it from us.
What about the people who have been in contact with the people when there's a positive case? Do you actively connect with those people and say, hey, you've been exposed? How does that work?
Yes. Once we have been in communication with the person who is positive and we can find out, you know, who are they, who's in their family, who's in their close social network, who have they been close to within the past 14 days, then we start reaching out to those individuals to let them know that they may have been exposed and to, you know, help them understand what that means and help them understand what they need to do to protect themselves and their families, because we want to stop the spread.
Great. A question from a listener here. What is the recommendation for healthcare workers to do at home to keep their families safe? Is social distance at home appropriate in case they were exposed to COVID at work and are asymptomatic? What should they do in between shifts when they're at home? Dr. Sewell, what do you say to that?
So what we're practicing at our own house, so my husband's is a physician as well that sees patients, and when he's coming home from work, he's changing clothes in the garage, definitely leaving his shoes out in the garage, and then we're immediately taking his clothes, putting them in the washing machine, and then he jumps in the shower right away. So that's our method. I know different people are using different levels of how to protect, and I think it also depends probably on how many patients that are potential positives that they're seeing. But right now, that's what we're doing at our own home.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Sefter, we have a question about food. Can you get COVID-19 by eating contaminated food?
That's not really a mechanism that's been reported as being important. There are some patients who with COVID-19 will have symptoms of diarrhea, but that's a manifestation of the illness itself and doesn't have anything to do with ingestion.
Okay, so you're not, when you pick up food from a delivery source and let's say somebody has been infected with it, you're not going to get it from eating the hamburger that you pick up, right?
No, I wouldn't think that would be. I think for fresh produce and stuff, washing it before eating and anything that can be washed, of course, should be.
Okay, just to make sure I understood. Thank you. What about travel? Judy, how are people being screened at airports, whether they're coming from overseas or they're coming from another state? What's how is that working?
Well, there have been a lot of travel restrictions that have been put into place, and actually with the executive order that is in place, the emergency order number 12, you know, we've been asked, we all have been asked that all forms of travel are prohibited unless it is for, you know, those essential services like groceries, essential supplies, or health care. I'm not familiar exactly with what is happening in airports, you know, regarding like what is TSA doing. I'm not familiar with that. But prior to even thinking about air travel, I want to encourage people to remember that any travel outside of their home community is not advised at this point in time.
All right. If someone in my workplace tests positive, do I need to self-isolate? Dr. Safter, what do you think?
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Absolutely. The question was, if someone in my workplace tests positive, do I need to automatically self-isolate?
For someone in your workplace tests positive, I think the question is to determine what your exposure was to that individual. If you were within 6 feet of them for an appreciable amount of time, generally considered to be 10, 15 minutes or longer, then I think that you would have to be in this, you would be considered exposed, and then monitor yourself for symptoms and then remain at home for that 14-day period if that's the recommendation from your employer.
All right. What are the symptoms? We hear a lot of conflicting things. Just heard a couple of minutes ago a mention of even upset as being possible. What are the symptoms? What should we really be looking for? Dr. Sewell, maybe you can answer that question.
You know, fever is definitely important. And one of the things also is that the fever can come and go. It can be something that you have it, a couple hours go by, it seems better, and it comes back again. Dry cough, definitely. Muscle aches, fatigue. Some people have sneeze, runny nose. That's less likely. The GI symptoms are less likely, but they are being documented of nausea, diarrhea. And then another one that came up this week is the loss of taste, loss of sense of smell. Those are ones that can happen either after the infection is cleared or at the time of infection.
I'm glad you brought up the sense of smell and taste, because we've had a couple of questions about that, you know, whether or not that and why would that even be a symptom? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, because the your taste and smell are tied closely together, that those sensations are, and your sense of smell happens up in the top of the nasal cavity between the eyes. There's some special fibers that come down from the brain and actually sense smell for you. And so because those cells may be infected by the virus too, so when your sense of smell gets knocked out, oftentimes your sense of taste goes as well.
Ah, that makes sense. Okay. Judy, what do you recommend people to do if they do start to experience some of these symptoms we've been talking about? What's the first step that they should take?
I think the first step that they should take is to keep in mind the infection control practices, the social distancing that we've been talking about, and the second step is to contact their provider, talk with their provider about their symptoms, the onset of those symptoms, and get the recommendation from the provider about what they need to do, if they need to come in for testing, or if the provider feels that the person should take care of themselves at home. Anybody that's sick, whether it's COVID or a cold or flu, anybody that's sick really needs to stay home and self-quarantine.
Is what we're doing right now, staying at home, working, and how will we know? Judy.
We will know how well this is working in a couple of weeks. It's hard to say right now what is happening, you know, if it's making a big impact today, but we will know a couple of weeks from now that this is working, because we will see the flattening of that curve.
Okay. Dr. Sewell, what do you think is the biggest misconception right now about coronavirus? What do you wish people would know?
That it's affecting all of us right now, and that the one thing we're asking everyone to do is to isolate. and to really adhere to the social distancing rather than, you know, well, I can at least go to the store. Try and plan your grocery store trips once a week or have the delivery if that's possible. Any way in your life where you can cut out another interaction with another person for the next few weeks is huge for flattening this curve. And I wish I could tell everybody individually, please adhere to this and don't expose other people. We don't know who has it. There's all this big asymptomatic population. It's critical.
Thanks so much. And thanks to our listeners for their great questions today. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. This is Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Another thanks to our guest, Dr. Nasia Safdar from UW Hospitals and Clinics, Wausau pathologist, Dr. Sarah Sewell, and Marathon County Health Department Public Information Officer, Judy Burrows. Executive producer today, Rick Ryer, also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at wpr.org/route51. And next week, we'll host the second program of our series, a discussion on the human impact of COVID in our region. Until then, we're heading out of town.